Hello, my name is Mark Vernon, and I'm joined by Rupert Sheldrake. Hi there, Rupert.
Hello, Mark.
For another one of our Sheldrake Vernon dialogues, we get together, we talk about something which we've been thinking about separately and seeing where the dots join and how we can amplify each other's thoughts. And hope very much that that does the same for those who listen as well. And Rupert, I have been thinking about something that I know has been part and parcel of your life for quite a long time, but has always been quite a tricky thing for me. And that is the nature, the phenomenon, the experience of praise. So particularly in relation to religion, of course, praising God, but maybe more spontaneously for lots of people, the kind of notion of joy, delight, gratitude, the experience of being that this word praise might capture. And the reason why it's been quite tricky for me is because when I was a clergyman in the Church of England, a long while back now, but one of the pivotal moments for me when I realized that that wasn't my call, that I was in the wrong place, was one of my fellow clergy asked me to give a talk on praise. And it really stumped me. I realized that although I'd been going to church for a little while and, you know, was actively involved in so-called acts of praise as a clergyman, I couldn't really say what it was and what it was about. And I was overcome at the time by this notion of a sort of God on high that requires continual praise from creatures far below. And it always seemed a rather obnoxious view of God to me, you know, as if God was some kind of divine narcissist that required constant affirmation. And it's taken me quite a long time to overcome that notion, actually, which it has done more recently, which is why I wanted to raise the subject with you. But I mean, this is something which I know you've talked about, and I wonder what you make of it as a first pass. Maybe in response to that, what I think might be quite a common objection, and why perhaps part of the reason why people can be put off the notion of God, as if God is some sort of divine tyrant that requires this kind of affirmation.
Yes, I think the word praise has got this baggage with it, that the thing that puts you off. And of course, it's very much embedded in the traditional Christian liturgy. I mean, one of the main hymn books in the Church of England is called the Songs of Praise. So it has that, all those kind of connotations, and I'd never actually thought of it as implying God as an ultimate divine narcissist, but I can see why it sort of implies that. For me, the one helpful thing is to strip away the associations of that actual word praise and look at the related words to see what it really means. And I knew you were interested in this, so I looked it up in my favorite etymological dictionary, Partridge's Origins, which gives the origins of words. And as you probably know, the origin of praise is the Latin pretium, which means value. And it's the same root that gives price. You know, how much is it? Price, how much, what value do you put on it? Or prize, which is, you know, someone's valued to give them a prize. And it's also underlies the word precious, you know, something that's valuable, and appreciate, and deprecate, you know, which is putting something of no value. And actually, when I looked up, I was surprised to see that it also underlies the word interpret, because interpret was originally used in Latin for people who are dealers, who are intermediaries in trade deals, you know, who inter between value, who, I suppose, like used car dealers or horse dealers or something, or you give a value to one person, you then sell it to another, and it's all about value. And then that came to mean interpreting languages. So when if one puts the word if one puts in the word appreciation rather than praise, then if we're giving thanks for or feeling grateful for what all the blessings on our lives, being alive itself and all the good things that happen to us and the beauty of flowers, now it's spring and all those kinds of things. If we think in terms of appreciation, it's more about us than about God as a divine narcissist. It's more about feeling grateful than the idea that God sits on a throne and requires people groveling around with endless words of flattery, which is obviously an absurd image and a deeply unattractive view of God. So I think when we see it's more about appreciating and gratitude, and if one looks at those hymns of praise or songs of praise, a lot of them are about gratitude for our lives, about the beauty of nature, about the even specifically religious things, grateful for the idea that as Christians, for those of us who are Christians, there's a kind of means of hope. So the kind of benefits of a religious faith, and the reason people have religious faith on the whole is because it does offer great benefits. It offers a sense of being sustained and connected and a sense of meaning and purpose and so forth. So I think of it in terms of appreciation, that it's good for us to be able to be grateful and appreciate things. And this is one of the lessons of positive psychology. As I show in my book, Science and Spiritual Practices, one major spiritual practice in all traditions is gratitude, being grateful for things. And the research by positive psychologists shows that people who are grateful are much happier than those who are ungrateful or who take things for granted. And that people who deliberately practice gratitude by making a list every day of things they're grateful for or giving thanks for the blessings in their lives, really seeing life, the glass as half full rather than half empty. That general attitude makes people happier, feel more connected, more popular, better at relating to other people. And it's also clearly the case that if we appreciate other people and encourage them, then it enhances their lives. And it's the same with us. If people appreciate what we do, it encourages us. And it enhances the way we can relate to others. So it's not that God needs encouragement, because presumably the supreme consciousness underlying the entire universe doesn't actually need encouraging to make more stars and galaxies. I mean, there's vast numbers of them already, and doesn't really need encouraging to make more species on Earth or anything like that, or even to make more people, plenty of people. So it's that way of thinking doesn't seem very appropriate, but the idea of appreciation is very important, and actually we get it in the puffs of books, endorsements, praise for this new book, and you get it in Amazon ratings, 5-star ratings or theatre reviews. It's a basic thing, and that comes back to its thing of value. How do you value something? If you think it's a really good book and you give it a 5-star, that means you value it. If you think it's a terrible book, you give it 1-star, and same with theatre reviews.
Well, look, I hadn't done the etymology. I love etymologies, and I hadn't done that one. And So that cluster of words is really helpful. And do you know the word actually which you said, which particularly stands out to me, is the word interpretation. And maybe I can try and link it to what has been getting me about praise recently, and actually relates to your point there about whether God needs praise. And I completely take your point that God doesn't need encouragement. As you say, there's plenty of galaxies around already. But the thing that's helped me actually is reading Nicholas of Cusa. Now, Nicholas of Cusa is this Renaissance philosopher, a bit niche now, but actually I think there are some philosophers returning to him. And I should just acknowledge that I've been put onto him again by reading a book by Valentin Guerlier, who teaches actually at Dartmouth College and the Temenos Academy. And that's why I've come across him. And he has a new book on Shakespeare and language. And he argues that Shakespeare was very fascinated by how we use language, and particularly whether it's a language of praise or whether it's a language of deprecation, as you mentioned there. But Cusa comes in, and it comes in like this, that Nicholas of Cusa realized that language in the early modern period was becoming uncoupled from God. And this is sometimes known as nominalism in the philosophical literature. And it's the idea that words don't carry an inner symbolism, but are just abstract signs that, as it were, are arbitrary. They could be used in any way. You know, when we say tree, it's just an arbitrary name. Even our personal names, Rupert, Mark, others, are just completely arbitrary noises. They don't carry any inherent meaning, and so relate to the objects in themselves. And, you know, that's now become part of a disenchanted cosmos, where nothing is sacramental, nothing is alive with anything apart from its own isolated, single, objective existence. And so science gives names, but only to label, whereas, you know, originally a name would have given, well, you know, in one way would have given you power over something. So, you know, hence names were very important in magic. But to speak the name correctly would be to release its life, would be to actually speak praise of it. And this is what Nicholas of Cusa argued back against nominalism, that he argued that the reason why there's so many seemingly arbitrary names for the many things in the cosmos is because all things in the cosmos are actually born out of the divine infinity. The myriad, myriad things reflect the tremendous abundance of God. And so what can seem like in one moment just pure arbitrary names, as if it's just a jumble, a kind of dazzling confusion of many things, actually is how the infinite might look from our finite perspective. And so when we try and use these names, we're trying in our limited way to give voice to the divine abundance out of which all things are born. And so what he's trying to do is kind of go with the nominalist tendency, but sort of flip it around and say that this jumble actually is like a cacophony that actually, if you pay more and more attention, starts to seem like a harmony, myriad voices, myriad names, myriad exclamations of praise. And then he actually goes a step further and says that you could say that God is the first praise. And because these many things, including us, are born out of this divine abundance, and so are God speaking praiseful things, if you like, that, because of course, when God speaks, things are, unlike us, when we speak, things are merely acknowledged or described or communed with. God's words of praise are actually what give birth to all things. And so praise has this deeply interconnecting kind of participative quality, that our words of praise are gratitude and so on, of course, but they're maybe even more fundamentally the spontaneous realization of our abundant life, you know, given to us, but also offered back by us to the source. And so praise is part of communion. It's a kind of expression of being. But of course, it's interpreting, to come back to this word interpretation, our being in its fullest possible sense, because it's acknowledging the nature of our existence, sort of born of this divine source, this wellspring, which is itself an expression of delight, joy, gratitude, sharing, participation. And so I've been really struck by this, because it feels like, in the most fundamental sense possible, it's trying to help us acknowledge once again the enchanted nature of all things by the very word praise. And you can sort of hear it, because when people speak delightfully about the cosmos, there is this energy, to use your word, there is this energy of praisefulness in it. And so, you know, you can almost tell when someone's speaking fully about something, because the air of praise and gratitude and sharing, participation, is carried by the word itself. And that's what Valentin Gerlier is arguing, Shakespeare is pointing out to us as well, which is why it's so lovely to speak Shakespeare's words, that they're imbued with praise, which comes from the original word, to use the Christian link, which is, of course, how Christians came to understand the incarnation of Christ. And so there's this incredibly rich vision of praise that I've got just quite recently, that suddenly has sort of exploded all my old concerns, and made me kind of want to be involved with praise, not just because it would do me good, although I've no doubt it would, but because it suddenly feels very fundamental to our being.
Interesting, that point of Nicholas of Cusa about God as the first praiser, and that's certainly true, even if you take the primal account in the book of Genesis, chapter 1, you know, God creates, says, let there be light, and the darkness and the light are separate, and God saw that it was good. And each of these creative acts in the beginning of the book of Genesis, and God saw that it was good. So there's a sense in which divine praise goes, as Cusa was saying, along with the origin of things, that as things come into being, there's a sense in which their wholeness or intrinsic perfection is really appreciated. And I suppose that the Matthew Fox calls it original blessing, that we have, that the entire world has this sense of original blessing, its origin is blessed, there's a sense in which whenever anything new comes into being, insofar as it's new, complete and whole, then there's something about it which reflects the ultimate source of all things, which is complete, whole, beautiful, balanced, etc. So when one looks at a flower, I look at flowers a lot. I'm very keen on plants, and I look at plants every day. The beauty of flowers, which is in many ways gratuitous and goes way beyond what plants need in order to attract insects, which have very, very small brains. I mean, there's kind of overflowing beauty in the natural world that we see through flowers and through beautiful animals with butterfly wings, peacock tails, and the beauty and grace of birds and so on. So many things in the natural world are intrinsically beautiful, that they lead to, if one allows oneself to appreciate it rather than look for faults and try and find reasons to complain, then there's so many things which we can appreciate, value, and therefore praise. And I don't mean praising God as a sort of divine engineer in the sense of Paley, you know, the early 19th century idea that God's the ultimate machine maker with the perfection of machinery that means that animals and plants are so perfectly adapted to their environment, the idea which Darwin deconstructed through the idea of natural selection. So I think it suggests that the entire creative process, every being, every organization, every pattern of organization has a certain wholeness to it. There's a wholeness to all self-organizing things, to crystals, to molecules, to atoms, to plants, to animals, to planets, to galaxies, to solar systems, forms of society. There's a kind of wholeness to them all in which the parts are harmoniously interrelated. If they weren't harmoniously interrelated, then the wholeness would disintegrate. So there's a sense of completion, wholeness, balance in all things, which, when we recognize it, we see as reflecting some ultimate wholeness or completion or balance, or which is the source of all wholes in nature. And so God would then be seen as the ultimate unity or wholeness from which all lesser unities or wholes are derived. And in that sense, through appreciating that aspect of them, we appreciate the source of them all. So I think of it as something like that. And now, I think, though, does leave scope for improving the liturgical activities of praise, because many of our hymns seem to me very 19th century in their feel. A lot of the hymns and songs of praise are, you know, 19th century, and reflect a worldview which many of us no longer share. So I think that the liturgical activity of praise could be improved and made more effective.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is this sort of sense of gap, if you like, between us and God, and somehow our response to that gap being closed by the divine act is one of praise, to receive that, as if sort of praise somehow is demanded of us, you know, a bit like, you know, a child that needs to say thank you to a parent in order to receive the gift. You know, that seems to me to present a distorted view of divine love. So I agree, but I also wonder whether what you were saying there about, you know, your appreciation of the beauty of the flower. I mean, it reminded me of William Blake's remark that heaven can be seen in a wild flower, and then this sense of wholeness that is in self-organizing systems, you know, even in a flower. And so the analogy of the completion, the complete beauty of the flower, would be an analog for the complete beauty of all things, and then the beauty of the wholeness that is their divine source. And whether praise is important, therefore, because in some ways it helps us see this wholeness. This thought in relation to praise has come to me from the work of Ian McGilchrist, you know, his great book, The Matter with Things, and before that, The Master and His Emissary, and his looking at how what he associates with the right hemisphere, this capacity to see everything in its whole context, as opposed to the left hemisphere, which is rather more interested in the particular and of itself can't relate the particular to the whole. That was picked up in a lecture that I just wanted to reference as well, because I know you were there, the Boyle lecture this year, given by Rowan Williams. And Rowan Williams was talking about attention and how our capacity to see the whole or see the part, is very directly related to what we think of as attention, which is as much about what we bring to the act of attending as it is the receipt of what we're attending through the senses, through data. And in fact, he's arguing that the kind of model that sees attention purely as if it's just like we were cameras receiving light onto a film and then making an image, that is now known to be very inadequate. And Ian McGilchrist picks up on this in particular, but other scientists have as well. Because what we take to the image making, as much as what we receive from what we then think of as an image, both elements are really important. And in particular, if we take a more open or expansive attitude towards what we're seeing and relate it to the particulars of what we're seeing, we get a fuller and fuller picture of the cosmos. And so Our mental field expands, our sense of reality grows. And it feels to me like praise has a really important part here, because if we go with an attitude of praise to what we're looking at, then we're open to what that might be giving to us back. It becomes a kind of two-way process, as if nature speaks to us quite as much as we speak to nature. And praise is certainly one attitude that we might take in order to achieve that openness. And of course, you know, the thing about praise is the more clearly it sees, the more beautifully it can articulate its word of praise. And so there's a kind of virtuous spiral in that, of seeing more clearly, being linked to seeing more openly as well. And so, you know, I the heavens are telling the glory of God, as the psalmist puts it. This is not just a rather beautiful, spontaneous response to seeing the heavens, but actually is a really necessary part to seeing the heavens at all, in any kind of particular way, and so communicating the beauty. You know, and you'll know better than me that sometimes privately, but on occasion publicly, scientists will speak even of the glories of what they're studying. And they might present it as if it's a kind of byproduct of the science, but I guess it's really integrated actually with good science, let alone with becoming more and more fully human, and so, you know, knowing our part in the cosmos.
Well, certainly a lot of scientists like to talk about awe at the cosmos. I mean, even very materialistic ones like Brian Cox and Richard Dawkins like to talk in that way, and I'm glad they do. But I think, coming back to your point about attention, as in Rowan Williams's talk, again, I think the etymology helps, because attention from the Latin ad tendere means to stretch towards, or to stretch in, add towards. So our minds stretch towards things. So what we see is not, as he rightly put it, like a passive camera image of what's there, but we actively perceive, we actively see, we have expectations in when we look at things. We have, as it were, fields of perception. When we see a tree, what we bring to the tree is a whole concept or percept of a tree, which goes along with the word tree, and is something that goes beyond every individual tree. There's something general about the very fact we have a word for tree that applies to lots of different kinds of trees, oak trees, ash trees, birch trees, etc. Means that we, as it were, abstract from all of those some common feature of trees. And when we look at a tree, we impose, as it were, that unifying picture of what it is to be a tree on what we're seeing. We're not just seeing what's there, we're seeing what we interpret as there through a form, the form, a generalized form of a tree that we bring to it. And one of the great points about medieval philosophy, before the nominalists came along and tried to break it up, was that our minds reflect the way that nature itself is organized, which is why we can actually understand nature. A lot of scientists often say, what an amazing thing it is that our minds that have evolved to deal with stone tools and, hunting woolly mammoths and things here on Earth, are capable of understanding distant galaxies, the fundamental principles of the cosmos, and so on. We're not just observing what's there, we're interpreting it through a whole set of patterns of interpretation, including what most scientists call the laws of nature, which are underlying principles through which we understand and interpret our experience. So we're bringing through our minds organizing principles to our perceptions and our understanding, which are similar to the very organizing principles of nature. Our concepts are, as it were, unified wholes that contain parts within them that are related When we say the word tree and our concept for tree, it includes parts like branches, leaves, implicitly roots, trunk, and so forth. And those are all parts within our concept of a tree, which are unified within that concept, just as within the actual tree, these parts are unified within the overall field or organizational pattern of the tree. And it's this relationship between our minds and the way nature works that enable science itself to happen, and indeed our understanding in the most general terms to happen. And that's the in terms of coming to that view that our minds are adapted to nature, there's one utilitarian view. They've evolved by natural selection to fit the way the world is, because we wouldn't have survived otherwise. But that puts us back in the kind of hundreds of thousands of years of Stone Age mental evolution, which it's very surprising. It enables us to build artificial intelligence and smartphones and jet planes and so on, which goes so far beyond throwing stones at and from slings at dinosaurs and so on. I mean, not dinosaurs, woolly mammoths. The these are so I think that there's a sense in which when we recognize the wholeness, beauty, etc., in the world around us, we see both an underlying pattern in that world, which in religious terms one would attribute to the ultimate unity and creativity of God, and also our own minds enable us to appreciate. So it's an interrelation, and insofar as we recognize it, it is a kind of act of praise just to recognize it. It's an act of value or appreciation to see that order or pattern or wholeness or beauty. And I think it's interesting that when people try to acknowledge the divine presence, they do so through acts of beauty. If you look at cathedrals, mosques, temples, they're usually beautiful. And if you look at sacred music in all traditions, it's usually beautiful because it's recognized that the part of the divine nature is beauty, and one of the ways in which we can reflect that back and show our appreciation is through doing something beautiful rather than something ugly or disproportionate or inharmonious or so on. So I think that the very nature of architecture and liturgical worship, insofar as it's in beautiful buildings with beautiful vestments, beautiful cloths, beautiful colors, beautiful smells through incense and other perfumes, all of this is a reflection of that beauty. So in itself, rather than just the words that we sing, that all that in itself is a kind of act of praise.
Yeah, and you're making me think about what might be disclosed by that loving attention, that reaching out, which you notice in the word attend itself. It reminds me of a detail which I remember being fascinated by and puzzling over for a long time, not alone. Others have puzzled over it too, which is how in ancient Greek there's no word for blue. And it's particularly striking because you think that if you were an ancient Greek living on the Mediterranean Sea with the lovely skies above you, the one word you would need is blue. But the thought is that blue wasn't differentiated from the wider world, partly because ancient peoples struggled to make the color blue. You could make lots of reds and oranges and browns from materials in the natural world, but blueness itself was much harder to make. And it's only when pigments like lapis lazuli became more available that blue became a color that could be used and then was named. Now, that's the sort of utilitarian explanation, if you like, but you'd still might think, but why wouldn't they still need the word blue, even if you couldn't make it? And I think that adding this element of loving, desiring, wanting sort of fills that last gap, because with the capacity to replicate the blues in the world through lapis lazuli and other pigments, comes a sort of valuation of blue for its own sake. And so that loving begins a sort of virtuous spiral where blueness is explored for its own sake, you know, much as redness or orangeness or yellowness had been explored for its own sake previously. And then the word starts to carry this resonant meaning because it connects to that which is not only, as it were, just out there, but is also in the human imagination. And so, again, gives this kind of this richness to the word and to all our words. You know, Homer, for example, had certainly looked at the sea, but he had talked about its rich wine-like hues, and so he appreciated it in the ways that he directly related to it. And the words appear as an act of praise, and hence blueness appears. But it also made me think about what we don't see if we don't have the words to praise those things that become invisible to us, and how another quite common experience from people who have had particularly first encounters with Indigenous people is that Indigenous people will say they engage, interact with, say, spirits that the person from the West just doesn't see at all. The writer Daniel Everett is particularly fascinating on this, and he reflects on it as well. And I think the way to understand that is that if you don't know how to reach out to something, particularly in acts of appreciation, in acts of praise, it may just disappear from view and become uncoupled from your experience altogether. So again, this might start to unpack why praise is so important for us today, because if you stop praising the divine, if you stop praising God, then God increasingly just sort of falls from your view altogether. And this is a sort of retort, I think, to the idea that by praising God, you're sort of conjuring God from your own fantasy and relating to a kind of delusion. It kicks back and says, no, maybe our acts of praise are that which precisely brings things into view. And so is why, for example, amongst Indigenous people, you know, ancient cultures more generally, the medieval world, speaking to that which is around you, it's not just an act of trying to fend off that which might do you harm, although certainly, you know, blessings and curses and so on are part of that as well. But it's actually to be fully engaged with the world around you by bringing it into view. What you take to it then directly determines what you see back from the world around you. So that sort of thread of thoughts has been ignited, both in terms of the puzzles as to why the ancient world didn't have blue. We now experience blueness in its variety, and so praise blue in how we use it. And so blue shows up for us in a way that it didn't before. But then conversely, what we've lost contact with, and because we don't think to praise certain things anymore, particularly what would be called supernatural and associated with religious activities. You know, to put it very simply, you might try and experiment, even, you know, just lighting a candle as an act of praise with the intention that it's a mode of communication, and start to see what shows up that you didn't see before. It needs discerning, of course. I have absolutely no doubt about that, because our fantasies and delusions can be part of what we're trying to perceive. You know, science is the history of that as well. But nonetheless, that doesn't take from the act. In this case, the suggestion is lighting the candle and what that might show up that's then necessary to be discerned in order to deepen the perception that otherwise is just lost altogether.
I agree. I think it's really important not to lose that. I mean, one of the worst tendencies that science gives people is that something's nothing but, you know, the candle's nothing but combustion, you know, with the oxygen burning the wax, and the flame is nothing but photons emitted by the electrons, etc., and the heavens are nothing but blind inanimate matter driven round by laws of gravitation and other physical laws which are purposeless and are nothing but mathematical formulae, etc. So there's this very reductive attitude that's come along with materialistic science. But the other side is that actually it's revealed whole realms, the microscopic realm, the structures of cells, of membranes, the structures of crystals, the existence of galaxies, which no one knew existed outside our own until about the 1920s, and the existence of so many aspects of nature previously unknown. So science is a double-edged sword, and it's often used in this reductive nothing but approach, but actually it can open up this vision of vast structure, meaning, pattern, vastly more than any previous culture has been able to know about or understand. So in a sense opens up potential for praise and appreciation on a much larger scale than ever before, and also on a more microscopic scale, literally through microscopes and understanding the microscopic world. It all really comes down to our own attitudes and the way we respond to it. And since the universe is reflexive, the way we respond to it will affect us as well. It comes back. And if we are able to praise and appreciate that which is beyond us, then that which is beyond us will have more effect in our own lives and I think enrich them and make them happier.
Yeah, that your remark there about what comes back feels to me the crucial element, and what comes back being related to what we take to. And as you say, there's no doubt about it, science has been this extraordinary act of acknowledgement, veneration, even praise of the material world, both the very small and the very large, and look what's shown up as a result. But it's not just that, not this nothing buttery. And so perhaps remembering that which this explosion of material reality has perhaps encouraged us to forget, by extending our attention, acknowledgement, veneration, praise. I like that very much. Maybe, you know, that's what we need to do now, partly seeded by remembering what attention is at all. It is a reaching out and a being reached back to. It's an informing as well as just being formed by. But, you know, the nice thing is, as to go back right to the beginning, you know, I feel now that I've understood praise a bit more fully and managed to shed off some of those older assumptions, as if it were God needing it or demanding it, like some kind of chief on a cloud. It opens up a whole world of praise, put it like that. And but I hope maybe for those listening, our conversation, the distance it's come, even by contemplating this notion of praise and seeing how it can open up different perceptions, even thoughts and comments about perceptions. Maybe that's of use to people as well. So look, that's by way of saying thank you very much, Rupert.
Well, thank you, Mark.